All right, welcome to the second session after lunch. My name is Nick Randolph. I currently run a company called Built to Roam, and we pretty much focus in the whole mobile space. And the first part of this presentation is going to be a bit of a history lesson about, I guess, where or what technologies we've used in the sort of the enterprise line of business space. And it kind of bit maps in a way to the way that Built to Roam has been formed. We started off building using pretty much the same technology we used to build Windows and Windows Mobile style applications. And track forward a couple of years, and now we're building sort of Windows Phone and Windows 8 applications using sort of the modern frameworks. And so hopefully in this presentation, you'll get an understanding of how you can map from one to the other. If you're stuck maintaining or you want to move forward an existing application, what the options are, and even whether you need to move an existing application forward or reframework it to one of these new modern frameworks. So hopefully there's going to be a little bit of code and a little bit of PowerPoint. The demos I've picked aren't heavily dev focused. They're really there to illustrate a point about the new technology and how easily you can wire things up. We're going to do four main sections. We're going to start off looking at a bit of technology. So this is going to be the history lesson. So starting at Windows Forms and ending up at Universal Apps. And we'll talk a little bit about what that means in a cross-platform nature. We'll look at how you can structure your applications and what frameworks are out there to rapidly accelerate them. So for those who were in Mitch's session previously, obviously he talked a lot about the cross-platform frameworks that are available both in the mobile web but also in the Xamarin space. And we'll touch on those a little bit, but predominantly we'll stay in the Windows space. And the reason I've chosen to do that is because a lot of existing line of business applications are in that domain, okay? A lot of enterprises are running Windows, a lot of line of business applications are going to be Windows. Going forward, that may not be the case, okay? Because increasingly, users are going to be on the move, okay? Increasingly, even if people are at a desk every single day, they're going to be checking their email on the phone. They want to be using their apps on their phone. And they don't necessarily want to be bound within the confines of the organization. So we'll talk about what that means from a security perspective, and we'll talk about what that means from an app development perspective. We'll talk about the options that you can do around migration, okay? So what if you've got an old Windows Form style application that talks to a SQL backend directly, how do you migrate that forward? And how do you use one of these modern frameworks to encapsulate that? And finally, we'll talk about deployment. And actually, deployment is one of those areas that has got so much simpler with the modern form of applications. And we'll talk about why that is. So to get started, we'll talk about technology. Okay, historically, you would have seen File New Project that looked a little bit like this. It's still there. You can still do this if you want, okay? I don't think anybody in their right mind would want to, but there are use cases where this is where you have to, okay? Going from there, okay, we step forward to WPF, okay? This was probably the Uber framework, okay? You've got maximum power, maximum responsibility. There's very little that jumpstarts you to building an awesome mobile-first, touch-enabled application, okay? There's a lot of stuff that you have to go, you either need to buy third-party components or you need to go and invest a lot of time to make it enable for mobile and for touch. Actually, I'll make one other point about WPF. What most people don't realize, and the reason there's two screens here, not just the one, is that WPF can run in the browser. And people go, isn't it a rich client application? It is. But actually, one of the early models about WPF was actually having it sitting in the browser, okay? You were kind of constrained about which browsers and on which platforms it would work, but you could actually do it. Move forward a little bit, and we have Silverlight, okay? This is the next incarnation of these modern style frameworks where you have where you're basically building the UI in XAML, and you're building your code in VB or C# and bolting it together. The first versions of Silverlight was predominantly JavaScript. And you know, we evolved and we kind of got a little bit more C# and a little bit more XAML, and eventually it started to catch up with where WPF was. Okay, all the time maintaining this cross-platform nature in the sense that you could run it on virtually any browser on any platform. Well, so long as those two platforms were really Mac and Windows. Okay, it didn't really work on the mobile. Okay, there were a lot of attempts at trying to get it to work on mobile. And in fact, one of the things that most people realize about Windows Phone is that the first version of the Windows Phone framework is based around the notion of Silverlight. Okay, so it's, and especially now with Windows Phone 8.1, you have two options. You can build in Phone Silverlight, or you can build in Phone sort of APEX WinRT style. So now we're into the world of modern applications. And one way of looking at modern applications is the Microsoft went, okay, well, there's a lot of stuff in these big frameworks like WPF that most app developers don't need. Well, what happens if we just get rid of it? Okay, does that make our model simpler? And the answer is yes, dramatically. Okay, so we end up with Windows Phone. Okay, so this was the first of the sort of the modern platforms. And this is Microsoft's attempt to go into the consumer space. They already have great frameworks for doing enterprise-style applications, so WPF or Silverlight. Now we need to emerge into the consumer space. And so with the advent of Windows Phone, Microsoft obviously needed a developer platform to enable app developers to build their own applications for the platform. And notice that the two screenshots I've got here really focus on this notion of live tiles. Okay, that's really important for Windows Phone and really important to Windows 8. What's interesting is they've done a bit of a backflip when you look at the announcements around Windows 10, is that those live tiles, those start screen tiles, become less dominant, okay? Particularly for those desktop-bound users. They're still there. And it poses the question is, okay, well, was that a reversal of the story? Well, in one part, yes, but the actual interesting thing about live tiles, it's about breaking up your application and building applications in a way that you can expose parts of them, okay? Your average developer goes and builds a Windows Phone application, they create one live tile because they're required to. The great Windows Phone or Windows 8 developers go and build quite a lot of live tiles. They enable different parts of the application to be pinned. And that's because most people, when they're going to use their application, wants to jump into a part, for example, a calendar. More often than not, I don't go to the calendar itself, I go into a particular appointment when it comes up and surfaces as a live tile. So even though Microsoft decided to go away from the start menu for desktop-bound Windows 10, the live tile notion is still important. It's still important to have that quick link into different parts of the application. The other thing that you get out of these platforms is you get a very strong notion of a contract that you're signing up to as a developer. And where that's important is it is important if you go and build multiple applications, you want them to communicate between them. There's some very well-prescribed patterns for linking one application to the other. And in the enterprise that space, that's even more important because you have, as an enterprise, have control over which applications users have installed. So if you want to push out two different applications for different parts or different functionality within the organization, you can do that. And you can detect whether those applications are installed. No longer do you have to build this one big monolithic application that does everything, right? And that becomes really painful to maintain and stuff like that. You can build discrete little applications that actually reference each other or can pass data between each other. So it's a big change in the mindset of how you build and deploy applications. Okay, and now we've got universal applications. The big thing about this is it's the next step towards having a single application that you can deploy and run anywhere. Okay, we're not there yet. Universal applications is not that, okay? You're still building and deploying a Windows Phone application. You're still building and deploying a Windows application. The advantage is that you can share almost 100% of the code, okay? The reason being is that they're now running on the same runtime, okay? You're still building and deploying different packages, and we'll see examples of the different package deployment formats later on, but you're still building and deploying different packages, okay? And the reason why this has taken a while to converge is because they are different package formats, okay? So for Windows phones, traditionally we've had a ZAP format, and going forward into the Windows platform, we've got an AppX format, okay? Windows Phone 8.1, they introduced the AppX format, okay? But they've said, okay, well, we need these few things, and they've added those into the AppX format. Okay, unfortunately, that's not quite compatible with some of the Windows stuff, so now the two are a little out of sync until the next iteration where they'll most likely combine. Okay, so universal apps are not that. It's really about providing that continuity of development. So the other big thing that changes the way that we build enterprise-style applications is the mode of usage, okay? And if you think most people pull out their laptops, or they pull out their slates, or they pull out their phone, those are quite often touch-enabled devices, okay? So that's key point number one. The second thing is that they're mobile, okay? Increasingly, people take their laptops home and work at night, okay? The significance there is they're no longer on the corporate network, okay? They may be on 3G, or they might be at home Wi-Fi. They may or may not be able to attach to a corporate VPN, okay? And if they are connecting to a corporate VPN, all of a sudden it's a pain to have to do that, and it's not a great experience, okay? So as we start to build our application, we need to think about how people are going to use them. Are they going to be pulling their phone out and wanting to, you know, check their email or check the particular application, in which case we need to make sure that application is really responsive, loads quickly, and doesn't have to connect to a VPN in order to work, because people just aren't going to use that. The other thing is that we need our application to work on and offline, okay? When we look at traditionally Windows Forms, back in the day when those used to connect directly to a SQL database, they're clearly not going to work offline, okay? Now going forward, when we think about an enterprise application, we need to start thinking about, okay, what data can we cache? How can we make this mobile experience even better? We need to think about background execution, okay? Most phones and Windows can run applications in the background to a certain degree. What can we do in the background to make sure that our application is a better experience for the user? Okay. And the last one is around bandwidth and latency. Of course, you know, those applications that make heavy use of the network are great within a corporate setting where you're on a corporate Wi-Fi or you're backboned straight into the data center. They're not so great when you're sitting on a 3G connection or you might be on a train and you're going down to almost a 2G connection, okay? You need to think about what's that going to mean to the user experience. So the next part of this is really talking about the application structure, okay? And this has definitely evolved, okay? I made the point before that we're no longer building these big monolithic applications. Increasingly, we're shelling them out smaller and smaller parts and that they can work together, okay? So we're moving away from this sort of maximum utility. We're not going to have a dev team of 100 people working on one application because, sure enough, that's going to grind to a halt as one team fights with another team that, you know, they're all trying to build the same product, do different things, and you're going to get merge conflicts. If you build it simpler, ship more frequently, you can build better applications and get more of them, get better productivity out of your developers. I'll make a point here about N-tier applications, okay? Back in the day, we built like two-tier applications, Windows Form, SQL Database. And then there was three tiers. We had a sort of a service tier, middle tier. Increasingly, the way we're seeing application structure now, we have that end tier, but actually in the client application and then the back-end services. So we have a client application that's made up of a page, view model, and then some level of repository or service layer in it, actually within the client application. And then on the back end, we're actually seeing the same thing. We've got a SQL back end, we've got some sort of middle tier service, entity framework or some other, you know, something like Hibernate or something like that. And then we have a service tier that actually exposes that. And it may be servicing it up as a set of web pages, or it may be serving it up as web API, or, you know, or God forbid, SOAP. And that's leading to the next point, which is we've kind of gone away from, or a lot of services have migrated away from using things like WCF and SOAP, primarily because they are very, very bloated objects, okay? And most applications just don't need it. I was doing some work the other last week, and we're actually talking about a new set of services, a new set of enterprise services that we're going to create. And one of the senior architects in the room says, "Oh, well, if it's going to be enterprise," and I was thinking, "Okay, well, don't we build all systems as being enterprise?" But apparently not. If it's going to be enterprise, it has to be SOAP. And of course, I then went to the product owner and said, "Do you realize we have to do this in SOAP?" And he goes, "Hell no, we are not doing it in SOAP, all right? Because our clients are all mobile applications, okay? They don't want to be talking over SOAP. We're much better off talking in a very light REST with JSON and potentially doing compression over there to make sure that it handles over the wire much better. The other difference that we'll also see is that we're going to move away potentially from using just a single SQL backend, okay? Now, originally, actually, I haven't changed it in these slides. It says NoSQL backend, and what I mean by this is that we're likely to see backends that are not just SQL, okay? It's not to say that the SQL Server doesn't have its place, definitely does, but increasingly as you start to look, particularly how you structure applications in the cloud, you're starting to see different styles of backends. Now, the implication of the cloud is something that enterprises are really just only starting to get their head around. Okay, most organizations say, "Oh, no, it's outside our perimeter. There's nothing we can do. We can't move to the cloud. We can't build applications in the cloud." Well, one of the most significant things coming out of Azure is the Azure Active Directory and the ability to sync your corporate credentials out into the cloud. Why that's significant is all of a sudden you can build applications, you can deploy them into the cloud, and users can use their same logon credentials that they'd use for your business, but now they're connecting to your application that's sitting in the cloud. Now, the cloud's got an amazing set of capabilities, and this grows every time I look at it, okay? One of the most significant things, of course, is scale, okay? But within your organization, you probably had some ability to scale anyhow, okay? You could prime up a couple of extra web servers, or you could, you know, scale out your data layer. But where the cloud is different is that you can scale individual parts of it, okay? So you can scale your web front end, and your web front end might be just putting things onto a queue, okay? So if you've got a high volume of things putting stuff onto the queue, then you can scale your web front end. Most likely your web front end might actually not take that much load, okay? You might have tens of thousands of users, but each one it's just dropping something onto the queue, in which case you probably don't need to scale that part. Where you might need to scale a thing is something is the worker process that sits and pulls things off the queue, okay? And you can do that dynamically. So if you get a, if you know that you've got a high volume period during the day, you can spin up extra worker processes to handle that load at different parts of the day. And that's hugely important if you think about the cost implications of running data centers and actually running things in the cloud. And I make a note here about queues and routers and push and notifications. One of the most interesting things that enterprise particularly are not picking up on is the use of push notifications. So you can pitch something off, so you might load something onto a queue and you say, hey, when you're done, send me a notification back to this application. Okay, so this is my push notification channel. Send a message back to me. Worker process picks us something off of the queue, does the processing, and goes, okay, well, I'm done. Who do I notify? Push notification out to the device. The device doesn't even need to have the app running, okay? Most of the platforms now support wake up in the background from push. They can pick it up in the background, do a little bit of processing, and then if need be, they can alert the user. Okay, it's a big change in the way we build our applications. Okay, so let me switch across to my machine and what we're going to try and do is a bit of a demo. So how many people here have heard of Azure Mobile Services? How many people have actually deployed an Azure Mobile Service production? Okay, so I've done both. and one of the most interesting things we're currently engaged in doing is actually using mobile services with Active Directory synchronization, okay? And what I want to do today is basically build and deploy a mobile service, and then I'll show you how easy it is to actually put Active Directory authentication around that mobile service. So you're authenticating your users with their corporate credentials. Okay, so we'll go ahead and create our new mobile service. So TechEd, AU, Melbourne, and we'll go use my free database. And I'll just step through these. It's relatively straightforward. Let it load. Okay, if you don't have any of these things like the notification hub set up, it'll automatically go ahead and create you new ones. We actually won't touch on the notification hub, but what they do as part of setting up the mobile service is they give you a notification hub. So if you actually want to set and send out a push notification to all your registered devices, you can do that for through Azure push notifications. Okay, we'll specify a database and I'll pick my existing server. Okay. Okay, it's going to go off and chunter for a little bit. And I just had a bit of a heart attack because I suspect that I picked the wrong option. Let me go and create a new one. Yeah. For those who are astute, they would have picked up that I picked the JavaScript backend for mobile service, right? Which is a tactical mistake because I wanted to show a .NET deployment. So Azure Mobile Service has gone through two major implementations, okay? They originally started with a JavaScript backend. So you could go into the portal and you could write Node.js to actually customize how all of the, basically the CRUD operations functioned. Earlier this year, they actually pushed out of the .NET backend. And the nice thing about the .NET backend is it's web API, right? So you can write your own code and you can customize it to your heart's content. So let's try this again, but this time picking the right backend. All right, .NET backend. We'll go through these process again. All right. Now, one of the nice things about this is it takes a couple of seconds just to create the actual mobile service. Unlike the JavaScript backend, where it actually automatically creates all the services that you're going to need, the initial version of or the initial create for the .NET side of things, actually all it does is it formulates some download packages that you can pull down locally, and then you have to republish up the first time. Okay, so it's hopefully ready. It just seems to have disappeared. Let me just refresh. Demo gods are not with me today. Okay. Right. Okay, so what we're going to do is, once it's created, we're going to step into it, and on the first page, which is the dashboard page, it actually gives you some great examples of how to get started with both an existing Windows phone or Windows application, but also it gives you the complete download package for your .NET backend services. So I'll go ahead and step into the dashboard, and sorry, prior to the dashboard, it's this one. So we'll go ahead and create a new Windows or Windows Phone application. They do have examples for the other platforms and stuff. One of the things that the mobile services team did from day zero is they made sure there was built-in support for all of the major platforms, okay? This is probably one of the first times I've seen Microsoft really staying true to their word and make sure that it's the same level of platform compatibility. So we'll go ahead and save that package, and I'll open the folder. Now, you on most platforms, you'd have to make sure you go and unblock this to make, because it's come down from the internet. And then we're going to head and go and extract that, and we'll go to C temp. And extract that. And you can see here that we've got a single solution that we can open. And within this, we'll have our service, and then we'll also have our Windows Phone and Windows application. Now, they've done a really good job of bundling this as a universal style application. And you might be thinking, okay, well, now you've got to publish it up, right? I do, and it's as simple as going publish, select mobile service. It's going to go off and look for the mobile services we've already created. And we'll pick take three. So it downloads the entire profile that actually it needs in order to publish that up. And we'll go ahead and step to next, and we'll hit publish. Okay, now this is going to take a few minutes, so what we're going to do is flip back to the slides. We'll go through the next couple of slides and talk a little bit more about authentication, and then we'll come back, check that it's actually deployed it properly, and then we'll go ahead and actually apply the authentication stuff to it as well. So typically within our organization, a lot of applications were built almost with an implied knowledge that we're going to use Windows authentication. So when a user uses their, you know, Windows Form or WPF application, it has the context of that user. And if you wanted to go outside the bounds of that, so for example, if they were not an administrator on their box, if you wanted to access the file system or do other things, you'd need to kind of bump up their privileges or you need to maintain control. Going through to the back end tier, quite often those Windows Auth would be used to access those service layers. So on your services, you'd also require Windows Auth, okay? And that sort of propagates within the organization. Unfortunately, when you go out to the cloud, that stuff becomes a little bit of a problem. You're outside the firewall, so not only do you have a whole bunch of firewall rules that you're breaking in order to enter the organization, you also don't have this notion of Windows authentication, okay? Windows Auth applies to Windows platform only. It doesn't apply to iOS or Android or even Windows Phone. I mean, Windows Phone really doesn't have a notion of an authenticated user on it, okay? What's important about the cloud is this Azure Active Directory and the ability to use Directory Sync to actually synchronize your credentials up into the cloud. That means that once you're outside and into the cloud with those credentials, anybody can use a Active Directory, Azure Active Directory to authenticate their application using the same credentials they have within the organization. Okay. So let's flip back and the power that is the internet is, okay, our mobile service is apparently up and running. Okay, so what we're going to do to verify that is we're going to go to our Windows application And I've got to make one little change, because by default, when it comes down, a mobile service is all designed to run locally, okay? And this is one of the nice things about the .NET backend. In the past, with the JavaScript backend, you couldn't run it locally, okay? It was very difficult to take, unless you were part of the product team. And I sat next to one of the product team members, and he had the whole thing running locally. I was thinking, wow, that's pretty cool. But unless you're sitting on the product team, you couldn't do that with the JavaScript backend. You can with the .NET one, because it just relies on SQL Server and essentially web APIs. We're not going to do that. We're going to uncomment this block, and we're going to recomment this block. And so essentially all that's doing is they've already populated this with the URL and the access key I need to access the service that I've just published. Okay, so let me just run this one up, and we'll go debug, start new instance. And we should see, this is the canonical example for Azure Mobile Services, basically this to-do tracking. And if everything is equal, what we should get back is a list of items. I'll hit another item, hit save. This is going off and connecting directly to the backend services and synchronizing it, or pulling that information down and repopulating that list. One of the nice advances that the mobile services team are looking in and actively working on is the ability to do offline synchronization. So you can now go and download the NuGet package to allow you to do offline sync. So without having to do any more on the back end, like literally nothing more on the back end, I can go and download a client library that all of a sudden does incremental loading and maintains a local database of items. I can make changes and update and add items. I can then push those back up to the back end. No changes on the server side required. Yeah, that's pretty cool. So they've done a really good job from that perspective. Okay, so let's go back into the cloud and actually look at what's required to do Active Directory authentication. Now this part's a little bit confusing, and definitely for the first time we did it, it struggled for about 2 days to try and get the various bits bolted all together. The reason being is that there's three parties involved here. There's Azure Active Directory, so that this is basically the key holder. It's going to be the one that actually authenticates your user. Okay, so down here I've got my Active Directory. I can click through to here. And I can, you've got typical things that you'd imagine within an Active Directory. So you've got users and you've got groups. You've got domains, okay, so you can manage more than one domain against a particular Active Directory tenant. So you can see here that I've got the default one, which was Nick Randolph built to roam.onmicrosoft.com. That's the one you get allocated by default. But I've actually added in this test.builttoroam.com, and I've actually verified that with, you know, so that I can actually use that as my login domain. The other thing that we need to add into here is this notion of applications. And this is where you're going to tell Active Directory or Azure Active Directory about both your mobile service and the native clients that are going to use to access it, okay? So you need to add two different applications, and these represent the other two parts of this sort of three-way puzzle. The first one is you need to add in a reference to your Azure mobile service, okay? So we're going to go through and do that. So add application. It's going to be, the name of the app is going to just be AU Melbourne. Now this name actually doesn't need to correlate back to anything. It's really just your reference within Azure Active Directory. What is important is that you need this sign-on URL and app ID URL. Both of these comes from your mobile service. So I just switched over here. There's an identity tab here. Mobile service, when it first came out, actually allowed you to do authentication using a number of different providers. So you could use Microsoft account, you could use Facebook, Twitter, Google, and one of the recent ones they've added is this Windows Azure Active Directory. So the part I need here is this app URL. And I need to plug this into both of these values here. And I go tick, once it's verified them. And to complete the relationship, you not only need to tell Azure Active Directory about the mobile service, you also need to tell the mobile service about Azure Active Directory. So I can go into configure, and I need to pull out this client ID here, and I need to go back to my mobile service, plug that in there, and I need to tell it which of the tenants I'm going to be using to authenticate with. So I need to do test.builttoroam.com, and I hit save. So the next part is I go back to Azure Active Directory, and this time I need to create another application. This application is going to represent my client application that's going to be authenticating against Azure Active Directory. So this is going to be our TechEd AU Mobile Client. I want to select the native client application. And on the next screen, it's got this redirect URI. Weird, okay. This comes into play much more with Windows Phone, because what happens when you go and use the web authentication broker, which is specific to Windows or Windows Phone, it's basically like a hosted version of the web browser, okay? But it's done in a security context to make sure that, you know, you're not going to get native applications hijacking, you know, username and passwords, okay? The web application broker on Windows, you have your Windows application, web authentication broker basically sits on the top and basically returns the authenticated token back to the application. That's great. Windows Phone, however, what happens is your application calls out to the web authentication broker, and your web authentication broker, when it's done, actually calls your application again back. It doesn't hit the back button and go back to your application, it actually invokes your application again. And it does that using this return URI or redirect URI. And how we get that from our application, and I'll use the Windows 8 application still, is that we can do that in our, the web authentication broker actually gives us a method to extract that return or redirect URI. So let me go down here to shared project. And I actually need to just grab this on navigate method out of here. I'm gonna plug that into our Windows application. Okay, and I'll put a breakpoint there and we'll just run that up. So our redirect URI is this weird thing which starts with MS app and ends in a GUID. So I'll copy that and I'll go back to Azure Active Directory, drop that into there, click next, and it's gonna go ahead and create our client application. Now, the thing that we need to do is actually glue the two together, okay? In order to do that, we've got to come down here and select in this permissions list, we need to be able to select the web application we just added into here and delegate permissions to it. Unfortunately, the application doesn't exist in there. It's not in that list. So I've got to go back to my native web application. I need to make a manual change to the manifest file, okay? So all of the settings that you see here is basically all housed in this manifest file, and they only expose some of them via the UI. So I go download the manifest, okay, and let's save that, and we'll open it. And I just need to update this app permissions section here. So I'll grab that, drop that in, okay? So this app permissions is basically allowing this web application to be seen by your native applications within Azure Active Directory. Let's go back to our portal, and this time from here, I'm gonna go upload manifest, I'll browse to the file, and I'll grab that file, hit save. I'll give that a second or so, and we'll go back to our client application, go to configure, and our application appears there. And so we'll nominate to have full access to the mobile service. Okay, that's done, we'll hit save on that. And so the only other thing I need to grab out of here is I need to tell my actual native application about this whole Azure Active Directory thing, which we haven't done so far. So I'll come back to our application and not this one. I'll stop this for a sec. I'm going to grab this in here. And so these are the three things that you need to specify. Firstly, you need to specify the logon tenant. Okay, so this is, remember I said that I had test.builttoroam.com? So this is basically you telling Azure Active Directory, this is the logon page or the login area that I want to go to. So test.builttoroam.com. I need a client ID. Okay, so that is gonna come from our Azure Active Directory registration for the app. So it's this thing here. And I'll just plug that into there. And sorry, the last thing is I need a resource. Okay, so this is gonna be the name of my Azure mobile service. And so if we go back to our other application in here, we'll see this in the dashboard, under configure. It's basically this name here. It's gotta go into there. And then in order to perform the authentication, we need to do two steps. And prior to that, I actually need to make sure I've got the NuGet package for Azure Active Directory which is a single line. If you do a search for Addle, and hopefully it comes back, and I install that. Okay, so now hopefully I can get references, good. All right, so the two parts here are, firstly, we're gonna go off to Azure Active Directory and acquire a token, okay? And this is their fancy way of saying log on, okay? So that's all it means. It's gonna go off and acquire a log on token. And the reason why they've separated acquire token from log on is because the next step in the process is you're gonna go and log on to Azure Mobile Services, okay? So they wanted to differentiate the two. And so let me just put breakpoints here and I'll step actually through this. So we'll go ahead and run this, because the second step is to then log on using the token that we get back from Azure Active Directory to our mobile service. So that's our redirect URI. I'll go ahead and run that. Okay, so this is the web application authentication broker that some of you may have seen. A lot of applications are now using it. For example, if you're gonna do Facebook authentication, you'd use the web just to make sure that users know that they're being semi-protected. Now I've got a user in that Azure Active Directory called test at test.built2roam.com. And this is where I really pray to the demo gods that I've got all three bits configured properly. And it's given me a access token. Okay, so that's step number one. Step number two should hopefully give me a user context back from that. Should hopefully hit the next point. And there we have our Azure Mobile Service user token, okay? And so you can then use that user token, or that user token will be used every time you call a service or every time you're referencing. So your Azure Mobile Service can then use that to determine which group a user's in. So they may only have access to certain tables, in which case you can lock them down based on those, okay? So that in essence is the bulk of that demo, just to show you that we can use the two to actually combine them together. Okay, flip back. Okay, so the next step is to talk about migration, okay? So we talked a lot about, you know, okay, we can build Azure Mobile Services. It's all great and wonderful. We're building rich client applications. But hang on, I've got a whole bunch of line of business applications that might be in Windows Forms, they might be WPF or Silverlight. How do I migrate those forward, okay? And so you've got a couple of options, but most of them involve working at how you can separate the various layers, okay? Most traditional sort of legacy applications are built with all of the UI logic combined with the business logic and all the data logic, and it's really all munched in together, okay? So the first step in the puzzle, before you even embark on working out which frameworks you're gonna be using or which interfaces you wanna build for, and you know, it may not be building for Windows, it may be extending your user base out to iOS or Android. In essence, the starting point is all the same. You've got to work out how you can separate the UI constructs away from your business logic, okay? And this is something that MVVM almost enforces, is this separation between your view and actually the view model, okay? And then the model itself, right? So the model, you can think of almost your data access layer. It could be your services, it could be your repository. It's basically what's going to be serving data up. Your view model is actually it's almost like a state management for your view. But the difference is that your view model is supposed to be agnostic of what the presentation layer is. If you can do that, if you can maintain that separate layer, all of a sudden you can rip off your Windows Form or your WPF interface and you could put a Metro interface on it. Okay, so then the next problem is, okay, well, that's fine, but I've done that, but now I've got this big dependency on, it might be a native SQL application, okay? How am I gonna cram that into a Windows application that doesn't have the faintest idea what SQL Server is, okay? If you're building modern Windows applications, it has no SQL classes. You can't reference a SQL database directly. You can do SQLite, but that's not the same. The other thing about the existing apps is it may be just simple enough for you to actually rework the interface to make it more touch enabled and more and simpler for users to interact with. And that may be the first step of what you do. So now if we're gonna limit it down to building for Windows, obviously we can build a brand new user experience, but we really wanna be able to reuse our existing business logic. And there's actually a couple of really good strategies here. Ideally, you wanna build out a portable class library. And I say ideally because in that way, if you're building as a portable class library, you can literally reuse it on any platform you want. So whether it be iOS, Android, Windows, Windows Phone, you can use that same portable class library to do the same business logic across all of them. But there are some severe constraints about portable class libraries, like you can't touch the file system. Okay, there's plugins available that enable you to get around that, but essentially a portable class library has no notion of a file system. And that's a pretty fundamental flaw when you're building a line of business style application. So the other options there is you can share class libraries, okay? And again, you can do that. And one of the arguments we make is that, you know, there's this big conflicting argument about whether portable class libraries is the way to go now or shared libraries, okay? And so, you know, it's a matter of working out what's going to be best for your business. The most interesting part of this is actually wrapping an existing set of business logic as a WinRT component so you can consume it in your Windows application. Now this unfortunately is very, very limited to Windows only. Not even Windows Phone, it's Windows only, okay? But it's really an enabler for businesses to move away from some of those existing applications and basically put a new modern interface on those applications. So what I want to do quickly is just switch over, and I've got a sample application that's already built, so you don't have to watch me write any more code. And essentially I'm going to run up, let me just close these windows. I'm going to run up the existing application. And this looks awesome, by the way. So you can imagine, you know, 10 years ago, we'd build applications looking like that and be really proud, okay? Yeah, a bit less happy about that now. So that's our native application. It does actually have a SQL backend. So it packages SQL, some SQL stuff there, and it uses that to populate the data, okay? So probably not great. So in fact, I can take a look at the legacy code, and you can see that in my data layer, it's basically generating a Northwind data context. It's basically using that to pull out all the employee data. Okay, we've all seen this kind of demo probably at prior years of TechEd of how to do this. Okay, where this falls down is, okay, well, I want to expose that legacy code, so this legacy data access tier into my modern application, okay? And here's my modern application. And it's been spruced up a little bit. Doesn't have the images, but it's kind of looking hip and cool, and it's very touch enabled, so we get all of the nice visual effects that we'd imagine in our application. The other libraries that you saw in here are all there to actually make that happen. So we've got our Windows 8 application here. We have this brokered component and this broker proxy stub, okay? So you can imagine what's going to go on here is basically, as you're building out your Windows 8 application, you need to tell it what native APIs are going to be available, okay? And you do that using the brokered component. And then on the flip side, you basically have to wrap your legacy application in a proxy, essentially, so that it becomes a WinRT component that you can then consume from your Windows application. And unfortunately, you can't have them at, you know, when you're building the thing, you can't have the two talking to each other because that would break all the constraints of Visual Studio and different processes and stuff like that. So what happens behind the scenes is when you build this, the proxy actually gets registered as a almost like a COM library as such. And then when your application runs, it basically talks down through that. And the magic that makes that let it happen is in your Windows 8 application, if you look at the manifest file, you have this extension down here that basically says that you're going to run an in-process server. And this is getting very, very low level, and it reminds me of, you know, those big, thick, waddy books that talk about COM Plus, and it was like, that's kind of scary stuff. The really nice thing about this is that if you go to Visual Studio Gallery, there are templates for the brokered component and the proxy stub, so you do not have to write them, okay? If you read through the documentation, you're thinking, I'm going to have to write all this stuff, don't. Go to the Visual Studio Gallery, grab down those, and you can actually go file new project, it generates it for you, file new project, generate them for you, and then there's one or two little tweaks that you need to make to get it to work, and hey presto, you've got your legacy application or legacy code surfaced up within your Metro or modern style application. Okay, next part is deployment. So if we look traditionally, when we built out our Windows Forms or a WPF application, we typically had to think about how we were going to wrap an installer around it, okay? And typically this was done towards the end of a dev cycle. You're thinking, hey, I've got this awesome application that I've just spent, you know, 3 years building. How are we going to deploy it? Well, you need an installer. Okay, that's great. File a new Wix project, write the installer. How many people are here written a Wix installer? How many people wish they'd never written a Wix installer? Right, yeah. It's a nasty, nasty piece of work, right? There's no drag and drop utility for it. There's some various helper things that you can thing, like I forget what the command line tool is that basically generates a whole bunch of Wix stuff for you, but it's really not a great experience. And then you need to start thinking about, okay, well, I'm going to modify these registry settings, and then you're going, okay, well, we're into weird territory here. And then you think, okay, well, that's fine, I've done the install bit. You then need to think about how you're going to clean the thing up again, okay? Or an upgrade process, okay? None of those comes out of the box for you, okay? Well, you kind of get a bit of an uninstall process, but then you have other files floating around and the users drop various things, you know, that they could because you gave them administrator rights. And of course, this is all done using essentially sideloading, right? So basically you could, you know, email the MSI to somebody and they could go, yep, okay, install. Now, in an enterprise setting, that's not necessarily the case, okay? A lot of user desktops are locked down to a user privilege mode only. And so effectively, this was done by pushing out through an SCCM package or group policy. So the sideloading problem is less of a significant problem, but if you wanted to do anything outside the user sandbox, all of a sudden you need to start, okay, well, I'm going to grant this user this privilege and da-da-da. So the contract around how your application package is very loose. If you look at a modern application, the deployment package is a very strongly typed constraint. Okay, it's a contract that the platforms know and understand. Okay, and actually that makes it really simple and really easy to deploy. Okay, if you think about traditionally pushing out an application that needs to be installed, you would have spent weeks talking to IT pro guy because he couldn't work out how to deploy it using SCCM, and every time he pushed your package through, it would break and it wouldn't install properly and then it wouldn't roll back properly. We were doing a workshop around Project Sienna probably about a month or so again. Project Sienna is like one of these WYSI build your own style apps. It spits out a Windows 8 application package, so an APEX. We got the IT pro guy in the room. He sat in front of SCCM, uploaded the package. Within about 5 minutes, he had it deployed out to everybody in the room. And uninstalled, he just yanked it. It just uninstalled off all of the devices. And it was just like, cool. Okay, and all of that is because you've got this containment. Okay, you know what the contract is around installation. You know that the user can't reach outside that box either. Now, they might want to go and add files and remove files, but at the end of the day, when you uninstall the application, it will uninstall all of the applications, all of the files that were built or generated by that application. So if you save something to local storage for the application, when you uninstall that application, those files go, okay? They get uninstalled with the application. Now, there is some limited sideloading capabilities. Now, obviously, SCCM and pushing out application packages is one of those. You can also do sideloading manually, okay? It's not really a prescribed way of doing it, but essentially that involves a manual installation of the sideloading key, which you purchase from Microsoft, to basically allow you to do that sideloading. And then it's a matter of running PowerShell. Okay, so if you're stepping outside the usage of SCCM, then there's a little bit more work. If there isn't a nice installer that you can run, although there are definitely some packaging tools that make that process a little easier. What I want to do now is just show you the same sort of thing, but actually for Windows Phone. So we're going to come back to our other application, the one we just built, and I'm going to set this as my startup project, which is our Windows Phone application. I'm also going to make sure that I've got some code to run. So let me just grab this onNavigate method, which I pulled out of the shared project. I need to plug that back in to make sure it's going to run some code. So let's just build and run that on the emulator. And by the way, both Windows and Windows Phone also support, obviously, deployment of enterprise applications through the store, okay? And I say enterprise, it's actually not. It's basically, you build an application for the enterprise, you push it through the consumer store, users download it and obviously have to sign into it, okay? There is no extended privileges about those applications. So you can't do this in-process stuff through the store currently, okay? So if you want to use the store as your deployment method, it's not going to work for those types of applications. However, if you've just got an application that you want to rapidly push out and you want the store to take some of that headache away from actually maintaining it, you can do that. Okay, so this is our Windows Phone application. It loaded, it has data. I'm gonna go select that and I'm gonna go project, store, create app package. Now you might think, okay, but hang on, aren't we gonna be sideloading this? You do. Okay, both for Windows and Windows Phone, you still do this via the create app package, and you select the no option is when you're gonna say, do you want a packages for the store? literally the store option, the only difference it does is it actually goes and connects to the store, downloads the package information it needs in order to for your application to be successfully ingested by the store, okay? So literally the actual package creation process that then takes place, exactly the same. So the nice thing about this is if you've ever walked through this wizard, the most painful part, particularly for Windows, is connecting to the store, assigning it to the particular application. Once you've done that once, you actually don't need to go down that path again. You can literally just create it locally. So we'll go ahead and select no to that. We'll hit next. We're gonna create a debug application. Yep, that sounds fine. We'll go ahead and create. And it's dropped it into this app packages folder. Okay. If you select the debug option, you don't get any other options. And you think, okay, well, what other options did you want? Let me do that again. Let me do a release build this time. Go ahead and create that. And it says here, down here, that this package will be validated. Okay, what's validation? It's basically launching the Windows App Certification Kit, the WAC test, okay? For Windows applications, this is available. For Windows Phone applications, it's available. They run slightly different tests, but it's the same concept, okay? Particularly if you're doing Windows Phone applications. We've come and grained so many scenarios where we've gone, what on earth is causing this when we sideload our application? And we've built and deployed our applications several times locally within our dev environment on our dev devices. As soon as we push it to our client and they sign it with their key and deploy it using SCCM or their package manager, all of a sudden the thing doesn't install or it breaks. And it's just like, and there's no explanation why. It just doesn't install, okay? There's no error prompt that comes up and says, no, your application failed for these reasons. It just does not install. And so what we found is that actually running the WAC test basically points out the things that we have not done. Okay, and they're quite often things like your icon sizes are wrong, okay? So you've set a 240 pixel icon for a 100 pixel icon or something like those. And it's ironic, those things break when you're actually doing those deployments because you've got this strong contract in place, okay? Run the WAC test. I'd encourage you, as much as anything, it gives you good coding practices and it'll tell you, you probably don't need these capabilities because you're not using them. Or you're missing these icons and a whole bunch of warnings as well as errors that you might want to address. Okay, let me go to this output folder, and what we're going to do quickly, I'll just drop into here. It generates this APEX file. For those who are not familiar with APEX, APEX is the packaging format for Windows and Windows Phone. It is actually just a zip file. Don't try unzipping it and re-zipping it. They use a proprietary zip standard, so basically it will unzip fine, but when you re-zip it, it won't be treated as a valid APEX, okay? Because they do the block counting to make sure it's exactly as it was built with Visual Studio, okay? So don't think you can unzip it, play around with a few things, re-zip it and deploy it, okay? That ain't gonna work. And trust me, we've tried it a few times. So what we're gonna do is actually run the signing tool. And so for Windows, the signing tool is literally you run this, there's a signing script. For Windows Phone, they actually give you a PowerShell. And this is because there's a number of different steps that actually need to take place, including doing a native compilation for a Windows application. So let me just grab the folder name for this. And we'll just drop this into here. So this is my APEX name, goes all the way to there. And I'll grab that. And so the construct here is basically the name of the PowerShell, name of the PowerShell script to run, the APEX file we're going to sign, the actual signing certificate, and of course the password, okay? And I'm gonna drop that into my run window and launch it. And it's gonna do a bunch of different things, okay? And hopefully, if you see a lot of green text, that's a really good thing. When you see orange text, it's like, oh, okay. And if you get red text, then it's really bad. So don't go any further. The output is another APEX. The difference here is if I go to properties, you'll actually see that it's got a digital signature assigned to it. If you actually open up the package, you'll see that signatures are then applied to all of the DLLs inside it as well. This is how it validates that this is a valid package when you install it. Okay, I'm gonna grab that like that, and I'm gonna drop it into pub folder, into apps, paste. Call it TechEd. I'm going to go to my Windows app, phone, go to the browser, and I'm going to go and so that folder I just dropped it in is actually mapped in IIS to as a virtual directory. I'm going to go apps TechEd.apex, Okay, and it's going to hopefully find that. Okay, it's going to go open, it'll save the file, and you're all thinking, hey, that's pretty simple. Okay, it's not that simple, okay? The reason why this doesn't sign, it doesn't install is because it says, you've signed that application beautifully, except you've signed it with a signature I don't understand or don't know about. So I'm going to treat it as an untrusted application. The way that you need to become a trusted application is you need to install the certificate actually on this device, okay? And this is something that would normally be handled by your MDM, but you can actually manually do it as well. And so we'll do that by installing what's referred to as a .aetx file. It's basically like a public form of your certificate. So I'll go and add a workplace account. Actually, it's not a workplace account. It's just enrolling that certificate. Go ahead and do that. And now if we actually go back and install our application, go open that, and it's going to install it. And there's no confirmation message because they didn't think about a UI for this, but it should actually appear in the apps list. I'll go ahead and run that, and it should run the same as it was running in our environment. Ah, there we go. Good. Okay, so. So the last thing I want to make a comment about is that the other advantage of doing a Windows application is that you can use it for single purpose machines, okay? In the past, this meant you had to do a custom build of Windows, you had to lock it down so that the only thing that could run would be your Windows application, okay? And that was uber, uber hard, okay? Now it's uber, uber simple, okay? There's this thing called, well, it's colloquially called kiosk mode. It's also referred to, because marketing got involved, it's called assigned access mode. And essentially it means it's available on Windows 8.1 Pro. And essentially it means that your application can be the startup or the only application that a particular user sees. So let me go out and what we're gonna do is I've got another user on here called kiosk user. I'm gonna go to PC settings. Whoop. I've inherited tricks off Mitch now. So I'm gonna go to my user accounts. I've got another account in here called kiosk. Okay, he's no longer going to be administrator. He's actually going to be restricted to a single application. So I'll make him a standard user. And then I'm going to click this link that says set up user for assigned access. And so I'm going to choose a user for him, for here. And then I'm going to choose an app that he can run. Okay, so he can only see, let's do food and drink. Okay. Job done. Okay, so now if I actually go and set him as the local user. And normally if this was a machine that was going to be publicly available, you would just not have a password on there. So that literally it boots and goes straight into that particular user. Now you might be wondering, because I've got things like the start button at the bottom down here. Okay, that's because I'm running the Windows 10 preview. Okay, in Windows 8.1, you would not see any of that background stuff. The app runs in the entire screen. There's no ability to minimize it, reduce it. You don't get the app bar. You don't get the bar at the top. You don't get the charms bar. It's completely locked down. Okay, if there's a hardware start button, that's available, but it doesn't do anything. The only way out of this is either to reboot your machine or repeatedly press the start key, and then the only thing they can access is the login prompt. Okay. And so if you set this up properly, they might see two users. They'll see their kiosk user and they'll see another user. And they go into the other user and they don't know the PIN number, so they'll come back and go, oh, kiosk user, okay? And typically you would not have a password associated with that, so it just goes straight in back to that one application. Job done, okay? It's really simple, okay? And now you imagine packaging that with your existing line of business application that you've repackaged as a WinRT component. All of a sudden, your application that you spent months trying to work out how you're going to build as a kiosk application, you've serviced up as a Windows 8 application. Job done. All right. And that is a wrap. Okay, so we've talked about a bunch of things. We've talked about the technology we can use, how we structure our application, how we migrate, and how we deploy applications. Unfortunately, we're dead on time. We do actually have a break now, so I'm happy to hang around for questions if people have them. I've also hang around just in case you want to come up and talk to me. Okay, thanks very much, guys.